Hello, everybody, and good morning to you. Good morning here from bright, sunny Finland as we approach the equinox, which is coming up even tomorrow. And I hope maybe I didn't ask, but Brett and Joe, would you kindly put the equinox broadcast link into the chat box so that people will be able to see it? You're welcome to join us for this ingress for the Aries, the beginning of the Aries energy. Now, today we're really beginning with number 39, not 38, but I just thought I'd review a tiny bit of this before we proceed further. We're reaching the end of this particular section, and I think this is probably the last time that I'll be dealing with the glamour of egotism, although, you know, we can't say that we have conquered this. This is the fundamental mistake that is made in the world of illusion, to think that what you see is what you get, you know, to somehow think that this small emanation which we appear to be is the real being, is the real identity. And then, of course, that leads to all kinds of complications until one day we realize that, as it says in Rule 5, the macrocosmic whole is all there is, and we are that wholeness. You know, eventually our identification, you know, over trillions and trillions and trillions, who knows how long any particular universe will last, especially in the inner worlds. You know, I mean, we may have some kind of incorrect idea about how long it may last in the outer worlds. Of course, science's estimation there is far lower than that of the ageless wisdom. So we have much there to prove. But in the inner worlds, of course, there's a tremendous duration of ongoing life. For instance, the Brahmanical calendar tells us that the solar system, our solar system, when you consider the inner as well as the outer process, lasts 311 trillion, 40 billion years. So all of us, you know, the universe is of vast duration, even though in the old hymn it tells us that 1,000 ages in his sight is like an evening gone. This would be the Almighty God, you know, the universal logos. But even for the character of a planetary logos, it's of tremendous duration, and that much more for what we are as a human being. So we'll make our way through eternity as forever we have been doing. But meanwhile, we have to overcome the great mistake, which is the great heresy of separateness. That mistake is major, because we are identifying the part as if it were our an entire being, our entire identity, and that is a fundamental error, and we can overcome that. And it leads, of course, to the glamour of egotism if it's too much emphasized, and if our ring pass knot becomes brittle and hard and non-expansive, and we cannot usually expand it the way we normally would. And then there's a very big problem. And of course, it's particularly acute on the first ray and the fifth ray, he tells us, from the psychological perspective. Anyway, we have not overcome the glamour of egotism, but I want to also work with us on the glamour of materialism. Now, this is, again, a fundamental glamour. And, you know, perhaps next week I'll be traveling to the United States, and I hope that there will be no interference in the usual broadcast or usual webinar that I'm trying to give here with the help of Olivia and Tuya. But I hope that if I have to, for some reason, cancel, I'll just continue the next time. But you will hear about it if it becomes necessary. But so far, if the airplanes work okay and the airports are okay and so forth, I should be there, and we'll launch into a new section of reading in the book Glamour, A World Problem, and also we will be dealing with a new and very fundamental glamour, because it's just about as bad as the glamour of egotism, and as a matter of fact is closely related to it, because we identify with the form, with that which perception reveals to us, instead of identifying with the observer. So we'll work on that. Let's just have a little alignment. We are gathered together here. You know, there's a number of us, and you know, I want to welcome you all and thank you for being here. Anne, Anna, Anne Marie, Antoinette, Carl, Catherine, Clesia, Dacia, Diane, Joanne, John. Let's see what's saying. Excuse me. I can't go too fast here, otherwise I'm going to miss it. Karen, Lori, Lulu, Margot, Marianne, Robin, Aristo, Regina. I'm getting ahead of myself here. I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. Martha, yes. Myrna, Regina, Risto, Robin, Tuya, Walter, and of course those of us who are on staff in case anything goes wrong, Joe and Brett and myself. So in addition to all attendees, AHA is here with us too, and some other people perhaps. So largely on three continents we find ourselves. The austral, New Zealand austral area, Europe, and the Americas. And our purpose to come together as if we were one instrument and render ourselves available according to the methods of hierarchy. And the formulas of hierarchy to help dissipate these glamours, these great mistakes in the realm of desire, where we exaggerate and minimize and do not see in true proportion. We're following things of little worth, you know, that's a glamour, to follow something that is not worth much or even really harmful. False objectives, desires for false objectives. And it keeps revelation from coming in and keeps the truth out. And instead, we are acting here as observers of reality as much as we can. The group of trained observers, we're not quite trained, of course, but we're on our way. And we render ourselves as an instrument under the impression of hierarchy, and for the sake of humanity, to help clear up this situation. It'll take a long time, many centuries, until the Sun of Truth, of reality, of love, of wisdom, shines forth on the astral plane, and these veiling clouds of glamour are dissipated, and we see things as they are with clarity, and we are no longer veiled in our estimation of what is valuable and what is not. And we will sound the Om to confirm that. Okay, well, all of you who are here, thank you so much, and we'll get into it now. And I hope I mentioned also, welcome Risto and welcome Robin. Sometimes my cursor jumps ahead and I miss the names I would ordinarily read. Just before we ended, you know, in the last section, we talked about the simplicity of the message of the Christ and also even of the Buddha, and how it, what these theological structures have become would hardly be believed. Of course, they know, but they would feel very out of place amidst all of the theological additions, accretions, we might say, that have the concrete mind of the human being has built over all of these years. And we also, you know, talked about the value of science and how one of the great glamours is that only in the churches can spirituality be found. Well, it's one expression of spirituality which has had its great problems as well. And, and along every one of the Ray Ashram lines, you're going to find the spiritual approach. Anything that improves the lot of humanity and the planet, according to the divine plan, is spiritual. So we have to redefine what we mean by spirituality and not confuse it with that narrow view that only the religious approach is spiritual. That may serve some Ray types, but it's a very, very limited point of view, you know. And I'm not saying that only second and sixth Ray types benefit from the churches. As a matter of fact, all the Ray types benefit, but then all the Ray types can benefit from the offering of any ashram, whether it is the, you know, clean and effective government of the first Ray and the social consciousness of the second Ray and the creative abilities to put that flowing golden substance money in the right place so that things manifest which are supposed to. The third Ray has that ability, or whether it's the creation of beauty and harmony of the fourth Ray, we all benefit. Or, you know, whether the technology and understanding of matter comes to our aid to save our labor for that which will really advance our internal life. That's the fifth Ray. And the high ideals which motivate us along many different lines, which are not only religious, they can be political too. They can be many different approaches to idealism, the sixth Ray. And finally, the correct magical order of all things. So they work together in a perfect rhythm. And, you know, that's not only for the magicians, that's for everybody. So we're all going to benefit from all of the ashramic contributions. And we cannot single out any one as being the be-all and the end-all. Of course, in any particular period of time, during a processional age, certain rays may be emphasized, just like certain astrological signs may be emphasized. For instance, in our coming age, we have Aquarius as the major sign, but all of the air signs, because they are air signs like Aquarius, will be emphasized. You know, the brotherhood of Gemini and the equality of Libra, you know, the law. And the sign opposite Aquarius will be emphasized, Leo, for good or for ill. As Dane Rudyard has told us, a great astrologer, that whenever you have a precessional age, it's not just the age of the sign in question, it's the age of the opposite. So we're just finishing up the age of Pisces Virgo, hence the very strong mental development under Virgo. And when we go into the Aquarian age, it's going to be the age of Aquarius Leo. So, you know, strong dynamic individuals will be found at the center of groups and so forth, as DK tells us. Well, all right, so now we're going to continue here with our section for today. It's just a couple of pages. It won't be long. And then next week, I'll figure out some area in the book which I think would be important for us to study. It's all important. It's very interesting, you know, that DK didn't exactly, what you say, write these books. He gave lesson sets out to his students, and they came every so often, and then they would be compiled later into the form of a book. So this is the case with the glamour work, and I suppose with the telepathy work, you know, the and even the healing. See, first we had lesson sets, and then later gathered for our benefit, so we could see everything under our eye at the same time. We have the books available, and probably, you know, in the next installment, it's going to happen that way too. It's hard to say, but from 2025 on, an amanuensis will have to be found. We don't know who that will be, but already I'm sure that the process is in the works, and lesson sets will be given out, you know, this time, of course, not just in written form and paper, but we have the whole electronics media, which will facilitate the whole matter. Anyway, we're certainly looking forward to that. But my main objective during these years, and I hope it's yours as well, is to assimilate all we can of the what has been given to us, this great body of teaching from 1919 onwards to 1949, assimilate this so that it really becomes a part of us, and so we're ready for whatever DK has to offer in the coming years, and beginning even maybe as soon as 8 years from now. Okay, so let's go on, and we'll finish this little section and then get into our meditation. The revelations of science, though focused often through one man or woman, are more specifically the result of group endeavor and of trained group activity than are the revelations of religion. Well, that's going to be hard for a lot of religious people to take, you know, because science is considered to be rather worldly and non-spiritual, which is a great mistake in understanding the revelations of religion, so-called. So he's going to tell us, well, you know, we have only to think about some of the great people who have, you know, the work of Marie Curie and her husband Pierre in the study of radioactivity, you know, around the turn of the 20th century, when it became the 20th century, so much was going on. The work of Einstein, the work of Rentgen, you know, discovering the X-rays, and all that group of fifth-rate scientists that came in such strength until they became too strong, and their work had to be curtailed a little bit, you know, because we were getting ahead of ourselves, and too much knowledge without sufficient supporting morality would lead to destruction of the kind that we, you know, it's said that the attempt will be made to destroy the Aryan race by fire. Now, the question is that attempt over? And has the Second World War been the Armageddon? Some groups consider it to be the case, and other groups consider that the Armageddon is in danger of occurring. And we have this incredible atomic weaponry and even more. So, you know, we have to make sure that it's just an attempt and not a reality. There's been already a destruction by volcanoes in the old days when Lemuria was destroyed, and then destruction by water. And here again, we have a different kind of fire that threatens us. And so we have to fight fire by fire, the fire of love, the fire of the will to good, the transmitted through the triangles, networks, and through the invocation of the Christ, the fire of love, basically. We have to fight fire with fire so we are not consumed by a fire by friction and electric fire, devoid of solar fire. That's where the Nazis and those groups made their tremendous mistake. They were into fire by friction, but no fire of love, you know. Anyway, so revelation comes, therefore, in two ways, he says, through the effort, aspiration, and achievement of one man or woman who is so close to the hierarchy and so imbued with conscious divinity that he can receive the message direct from the central divine source. And by that, I assume we mean hierarchy, or maybe in some cases, the Shambhala influences there when it comes to atomic energy. The Shambhala influence was there. You know, it's kind of interesting. I think there was a, how did it go? One of the major scientists working on the atomic revelation, you might say, the atomic bomb, was Robert Oppenheimer, and he was brilliant, and he has studied Sanskrit. And when he saw the bomb go off in the tests at Alamogordo, New Mexico, he was somehow the quotation was coming to him about the great power of destruction from the Indian literature. He was just obviously he was a reincarnation of something that went on in that way earlier, because it is said that even the great battle, which took place on the plains south of Delhi, and this was the great war in the Atlantean period, had weapons of amazing destructive power. Were they atomic weapons? Who knows? But or were they worse and even more destructive? But he was made to quote this, and I wish I had the quote, but it just came to my mind. But it was all about the destructive power of Shiva, or you know, or the great destroyers from the Sanskrit. The first ray was involved with the fifth ray in giving us atomic energy, obviously. So the central divine source is increasingly Shambhala as well, you know, with all of these shambolic impacts starting in 1825, and then, you know, going to 1950, and also to the year 2000. But even the period around 1925 seems to have involved something of that energy. Okay, so such an individual as this, such a revealer as this, he has joined the ranks of the great intuitives and works freely in the world of divine ideas. And let's see if I you know, I'm sometimes I forget to bring these things up the way I would like to. In the AAB diagrams, which I certainly should have had ready to go. Let's see. Open with, and I'll open with whatever this is. We remember that our divine ideas don't even begin until we reach the cosmic ethers. So the very first source of divine ideas is the Buddhic plane, and on all of the other cosmic etheric planes, we might say that divine ideas have their home. But of course, we can't stop there. You know, all beings are really ideas, and so we would go even higher in the search for divine ideas. But one place where you don't find divine ideas per se is in the lower 18 subplanes, or even the lower 21 subplanes, which is the physical vehicle of the planetary and solar logos. So anyway, from the realm of divine ideas, he knows his mission. This is a very high soul, how these revelations come. He knows his mission clearly. He chooses his sphere of activity with deliberation, and I suppose according to his ray, you know, he isolates the truth or truths which he deems appropriate to the need of the time. So basically, he is a, you know, he's somehow not only close to hierarchy, sorry, but can be considered broadly a member of hierarchy. You know, if we are even initiates of the first and second degree, we are included within the hierarchical circle, and I'll show you how that works right here. Take a look at this. This is very interesting because, see this big circle of blue? That's considered the planetary hierarchy, and right below it, I don't know if I can make this any bigger. That's a problem. Maybe I can. We see the grades of initiates 1, 2, 3, and 4. Various grades of disciples, people on the probationary path, somehow they're all included within this great blue circle of hierarchy. So that's considering hierarchy in the broad sense, not that you have to necessarily be a master of wisdom before you're really a member of hierarchy. There's two ways to consider that. Okay, so anyway, he chooses his sphere of activity, he isolates the truth. According to his ray line, I believe, he comes forth as a messenger of the Most High. Certainly, Master DK is that. He's a master who is classically the messenger. from Mercury, you might almost say, leads a dramatic and arresting life of service and symbolizes in his life events certain basic truths which have already been revealed, but which he pictorially reenacts. Well, you know, such a one, if I can say so, such a one was the initiate, Jesus, or Jeshua. He came forth as a third degree initiate, and he had a dramatic and arresting life of service, and he is revealing, according to the one who is overshadowing him, he is revealing the great principle of love, according to his great ideal, who was the Christ. So such a person as this, he epitomizes in himself the revelations of the past. And, you know, and he had quite an illustrious past, we're told, Jesus did. And to them, he adds his own contribution of the new revelation, which it is his specific function to practice in the world. And it was a revelation of sacrifice, particularly of willing sacrifice for the sake of love. We don't know, well, at least I don't know, the monadic ray of Jesus. Sometimes I think it's the second ray. Sometimes I think it's the first ray, you know, because he is the commanding general, as they say of him, and no soft character such as the mistaken notions of many religious people seem to think. But anyway, this is a very high revealer. He is a natural intuitive, a great intuitive. This is different. Now, there's also another type of revelation that can come forth when we're speaking of the intuition, and the revelation will come through the effort of a group of seekers, such as the scientific investigators in every country who together are searching for light. In other words, a very strong group process, and more so than even in the area of religion. Together, they are searching for the light on the problems of manifestation, or for some means to alleviate human suffering, and a revelation comes. So when the motive is correct, and the intensity of the desire to alleviate human suffering or planetary suffering is sufficiently strong, then revelation can come, because then a funnel will be created which allows the content of the cosmic ethers to descend via a kind of antikorana. The effort of such a group often lifts upon its wings. This is interesting. This is real group work, okay? It often lifts upon its wings of its unrealized aspiration, because so many scientific people don't consider themselves spiritual in the classical sense, but they certainly aspire for the truth. Some one man who can then penetrate into the world of divine ideas and there find the longed for cure or key, and thus he intuitively discovers the long sought secret. So, you know, you can think of such a one as Einstein being lifted by the efforts of so many of those within this fifth ray, third ray kind of ashram. You can think of Jonas Salk in his discovery of polio, the vaccine, and so forth. You can think of great ameliorative measures that have come forth from someone who has discovered the cause, the cure, the reason. But the important thing to realize is this is a group process, and such an individual couldn't achieve it just by themselves. They're being lifted by all the work that went on before. The discovery, and that's interesting, because discoveries come from the world of the intuition, right? In other words, the answers are already there. I remember my old teacher used to say, you know, look, he says, if God made the disease, you can be sure he made the cure. It impressed me. And of course, at the time I was very young, and I was the victim of many earlier type of thoughts which were not accurate. And that was a very arresting statement, you know, because we're trying to cure cancer. Well, it's as if the cure doesn't exist, but the cure does exist, you see. And it's a question of the intuitives to find the way to recognize it and bring it through. So some secret is discovered which will help humanity. This is the purpose of the intuition, really to advance the divine plan according to the divine purpose. The discovery, when it's very high, when it's of the first rank, is as much a revelation as the truths presented by the world teachers along the second ray line, right? And who shall say, I love this kind of statement, because somehow it really broadens our point of view. Who shall say that the statement that God is love is of more value than the statement that all is energy? So the statement that all is energy is coming out of the fifth ray ashram. The statement God is love is coming out of the second ray ashram, and he's really causing us to question here. The the root which the revelation then follows is the same in both cases. And, you know, this is the sad part, of course, but inevitable. And illusion overtakes them both, both forms of revelation. But, and here's the point that I would ask you to reflect upon, and this is interesting, there is a little less illusion gathered around the revelations of science than has gathered around the revelations of what humanity calls the more definitely spiritual truth. Maybe, well, let's see what he says. One reason lies in the fact that the last great spiritual revelation given by the Christ was given 2,000 years ago. And the development of man's mind and his responsiveness to truth has grown greatly since that time, under the Pisces-Virgo age, especially the Virgo part of it. Again, the revelations of science are largely the result of group tension, eventually focused in one intuitive recipient, and the revelation is protected by the group. Which is interesting, because you have all these thinkers, and we're not just running away with the show, thinking that somehow, you know, what one person says is the be-all and the end-all. We have the reasoning, the clear thinking of a whole group, which tests out the revelation of the one great revealer in this group. I'm remembering, if I'm correct, that this whole thing about the theory of relativity coming from Einstein, was it true, was it not true? So a test some years later, and maybe it's 14 years later, or quite a while later, 14, 15 years later, a great scientist by the name of Arthur Eddington, I think it was Arthur, but it was Eddington for sure, there was an opportunity to make some astronomical observations to see whether light would bend. But it, as Einstein had said, it would, because this is a good fifth-ray test for a great third-ray speculation, in a way. So, in fact, cloud cover could have prevented the whole thing. But at least on one of the two places where observation could occur, it was clear, and it was clear that there was a bending of light. The planet Mercury was involved. I don't know the fifth-ray details, but it was confirmed. That whole fifth ray group actually got out there, and they confirmed what the speculative intuitive Einstein had said. What was interesting about it, when Einstein was questioned, well, what would you have done if this could not have been proven because of the cloud cover or unfavorable observation conditions, is, well, it wouldn't have made a difference because I know it's true anyway. So this is the conviction of the intuitive who sees the truth as it is, but for the sake of the lesser minds, and let us number ourselves among them, proof along the fifth ray mental line has to be given. Today, as humanity awaits the revelation, which will embody the thoughts and dreams and constructive goal of the new age, we're not exactly sure what that will be, but we have some idea, the demand for the first time from a large group of intuitively inclined people, the demand comes from them. He doesn't say intuitives. He says intuitively inclined. And if we are modest and truthful, maybe we can think of ourselves as among the intuitively inclined, not as great intuitives. I said not intuitives, brother of old. The group is now so large, and its focus is now so real, and its demand so loud that it is succeeding in focusing the massed intent of the people. And this is invoking, of course, this is calling down the reappearance of the Christ and the externalization of the hierarchy and all kinds of realizations in connection with what hierarchy really is. Therefore, whenever revelation may emerge, whatever revelation may emerge in the immediate future will be, and this is interesting, better protected by the spirit of understanding than any previous one. Just the same way that these scientists have their brilliant mind to protect against any errors in reasoning and in thought, so the spirit of understanding along the invocative secondary line will protect the coming revelation. DK tells us about a revelation that's coming, of course, that's again in the fifth ray department. He says it will be to astronomy what the Copernican revolution was to the geocentric theory. The geocentric theory put Earth in the middle of everything. Then along came heliocentrism with Copernicus. It was very dangerous to even talk about that kind of thing because egoism is so strong that people will fight to stay at the center of things rather than allow decentralization. So now the sun is the center of things, you know, and it took us some hundreds of years before that could even be allowed by the prevailing orthodoxy. And then there are coming still more decentralizing realizations, he promises us. So this is the significance of the words of the New Testament, every eye shall see him. We are invoking the hierarchy and the Christ. Now here he says something different than he says elsewhere. He says, humanity as a whole will recognize the revealing one. The revealing one, in my view here, is the Christ, but elsewhere he tells us that the Christ is coming for his own. And while everyone will see him, not everyone will recognize who he is. So it just depends on which reference you want to emphasize and whether in some way both can be true. In past ages, the messenger from on high was only recognized and known by a mere handful of men. Well, that will not be the case now. And it took decades and sometimes centuries for his message to penetrate into the hearts of humanity. That is not the case. But he also emphasizes that not all people will realize who the Christ really is. Now, you know, I'm determined here, so please give me the benefit of the doubt. I must finish this. So that we can get on to new material the next time. The stress of the times, okay, we are really in stressful times, also, and the development of the sense of proportion under Libra, which is becoming stronger and stronger. So we'll, you know, we cannot deny that there's something unusual about the great being that's coming forth. We will understand his status, although DK warns us that if the Christ doesn't time his reappearance correctly, there are so many high quality people that he might not be recognized because, you know, there are many of a high status that are coming forth. Plus an enforced, now this is interesting, an enforced return to simplicity of living, probably under Saturn. You know, Saturn rules the first 720 years of the Aquarian age, and simplicity will be forced back upon us. To simplicity of living and requirements may save the coming revelation from too swift and quick submergence in the fire of the great illusion, which is the way, you know, the physical etheric plane, basically the dense physical body of the planetary logos, covers and veils the truth that's coming from the cosmic ethers. So stress can be helpful because it doesn't allow you to relax into complacency. The sense of proportion will keep the glamours down, and simplicity will make us focus on what is essential and not become preoccupied with all those other things which can distract us from the truth. Okay, a little more. It will be, yes, see, only one more paragraph. It will be apparent to you from the above that the mode of handling world affairs, states of consciousness, and conditions in the three worlds is one in which the disciple and initiate work from above downward. Now, we're always taught that the occult method works from above downward. And we ourselves are kind of learning how to do that, although the empirical method often is the reverse. We study the conditions and we generalize ourselves back to the principles. Actually, I think that both are necessary simultaneously, the deductive method and the inductive method both. The method is in reality a repetition of the involutionary art long, long ago, in which, like the creator, from a vantage point of exterior direction from on high, energy, force, and forces are directed into the world of phenomena and produce definite effects upon the substance of the three planes. As esotericists, that's how we're learning to work. We take these esoteric energies within us and in the larger, higher sphere, and we direct them constructively according to the power of intuition and the power of thought into the world to make the changes which are required by the divine plan. So this is a point which must be most carefully remembered, he says, and it is for this reason. So I've gone out of order here a little bit, but for a reason. It is for this reason that the technique of the presence, which is what we've been studying all the time and has to do with the real factor of being within us, this technique of the presence must always be employed prior to all other techniques. Well, we're working with the technique of light first. And, you know, do I have an excuse for that? Well, let's just say that's where the real glamour work, the attack on glamour per se, is occurring. And then, you know, in my view, comes the attack on the world illusion, even though glamours are derived from illusions for the most part. At least in the present intelligent age, maybe it wasn't always so, because people didn't have the thinking power to fall into illusion. They just had the power that messed up their desires. So they desired things of no worth and were led astray by the falsity of those desires. So anyway, the technique of the presence is what we have been studying these several months. It establishes contact with the directing spiritual agent. Okay, now that's within our nature, which is the true soul and ultimately the true monad, and enables the disciple to assume the attitude of the detached observer. Who is the observer? Ultimately, the observer is the monad, the point of true being, and an agent of the plan. So is any of us truly the detached observer? Are we an agent of the plan? Well, let's hope increasingly so. When this technique is correctly followed, it brings the intuition into play from the Buddhic plane and beyond, and the world of meaning, which is the world of the soul, and even within the egoic lotus, we have the revelation of the world of meaning, lying behind the world of phenomena. So the world of phenomena is very much the 18 lower subplanes, and let's see if I can get back to where I belong here. Oh, no, it's not going to let me do that. I'm so sorry. I thought I could move here, but I'm not moving. So anyway, just try to remember that. Try to remember that chart. Sometimes this happens. My arrows suddenly gray out, and I can't move. Don't let your arrows gray out. So anyway, the lower 18 subplanes really are the world of a phenomena, the truly dense physical body of our planetary logos. Anyway, the world of meaning comes into view, the intuition comes into play, the phenomena no longer veil the truth, and the meaning of things stands revealed and illusion is dispelled. Truth as it is seen and known. The true intuitive sees truth as it is, forms in the outer world of phenomena, outer from the angle of the soul and therefore encompassing the three worlds of our familiar daily living, are seen as but symbols of an inward and spiritual reality. And that is called a spiritual reading. We read about that, you know, when we're in the arcane school and studying all of this stuff, you know, we read here about viewing all things as symbols of a higher or inner reality. And that maybe that begins to really take place when we're able to contact the first level of the higher three subplanes, where spiritual discernment on subplane number three is at last contacted. We can see how the outer form is simply a replication or a hint about something far more real internally. And, you know, astrology, study of astrology helps a lot with that. Okay, friends, well, I know I've been going on and on here, but this takes us to the end of this particular section. And we'll start with number 39 at some page, which I'll have to choose. So I call it page XXX, whatever. And we will then work on a new section with the glamour of materialism. But for now, we're still going to have one more meditation on the glamour of egotism. And maybe through the right sense of proportion, whatever egotistical tendencies we have regarding ourselves as the center of everything are beginning to fade, and we will truly achieve that necessary decentralization without which our perception of truth is veiled. So now, I'm going to open the floor to whoever would like to ask a question, make a statement, either in written form or verbal form. And if for some reason I miss your hand or your question mark, then Brett will help me find it. So we have finished this section on the technique of the presence, by means of which intuition is awakened, dispelling illusion, and ending the fragmentation which the lower concrete mind normally reveals to us, so we cannot see the wholeness of things. Okay. I'm looking for if you have any question or any statement here. And remember, okay, here's Vera. And Vera.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Yes. Michael, question about Sutratma, three fire energy fires in the spinal column and Kundalini. So is it correct that Sutratma is the life thread from its first aspect? The Kundalini is the matter, and the three fires in the spinal column relates to the consciousness as we develop, so they sort of vivify and would that be rough?
Well, I think you know, it depends on how we look at it. The Kundalini is, in a way, the entire process of using Pluto and the first ray at the base of the spine to raise the fire of matter into the head, where purpose is found. So Kundalini is the whole thing. Kundalini is the Ida and the Pingala and the Shushumna. Now, generally speaking, the Shushumna, which is the central channel, is related to the first ray. The Pingala to the soul and the second ray, and the Ida on the left, as you are looking at the individual, would be specifically the fires of matter. So the Ida is first aroused. And then when we begin soul culture, the Pingala is aroused. And finally, when we're at the point where we're contacting the will, the true Shushumna, true central channel carrying the first ray, clears all before it and rises into the head center, where purpose is realized and the crown center is completely unfolded. So, you know, in a way, the threads of the Antikarana will correspond with this work of the Kundalini. So the Sutratma corresponds with the first aspect and with life, the consciousness thread more with the Pingala and the soul energy, and then the creative thread more along the third ray with the Ida. But sometimes the creative thread comes last in order. Sometimes we oftentimes say, well, the third ray shows itself first. It does. But in terms of our ability to really manipulate, life is there, consciousness is there, and only then does the true creativity unfold. So it's kind of a 1-2-3 becomes 3-2-1, or maybe I should say it the other way. Finally, we become creative and can use that creative thread properly. But let's just say that all of this is timed out. It has to do with the monadic ray. According to the monadic ray, so do the triangles in the etheric body awaken, with different emphasis upon the centers. Now, I'm trying to think, It's usually that the part of the triangle representing the third ray awakens first, second ray second, and first ray third. But there are some, what can I call them, changes or modifications that occur. For the first ray type, the part of the triangle emphasizing the first ray awakens much more rapidly than for other types, even though it's usually the last to awaken. So love is a problem for the deeply monadic first ray type. For the second ray type, knowledge ends up being the problem and is slower in awakening. Also, so what it means is that the second ray part and the third ray part, instead of being successive to each other, awaken more or less the same, because there's such an emphasis upon love. And in my view, the third ray type has difficulty awakening the will, because there are so many intelligent ways to escape the necessity for sacrifice. So the awakening of these triangles, according to the monadic ray, has a lot to do with the manner in which Kundalini rises and energizes different triangles along the way. It's extremely intricate. I don't pretend to be able to describe the process in detail, but the principles are there. So basically, we have Kundalini is the whole thing. The central channel is the first ray, generally speaking, Pingala the second ray, and Ida the third ray. And this has a correspondence to the three threads of the Antikarana and to the general triangular awakening of the etheric body according to the monadic ray. All of these different systems are interlocked in a way that really only the master knows. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you bet, Vera, you bet. Okay. Okay, other thoughts? Okay, hold on. Tuya? Yes, go ahead, Tuya. Please, hold on. Wait. You'll have to unmute yourself. Can you do that? I hope that I'm not the one who's responsible for keeping you on mute. Can you find the cord there? And okay, I every time I hit this thing, you are self-muted, and unless you can unmute yourself, we won't be able to hear you. So is there a green button anywhere or a green circle? Yeah, it says you're self-muted. So you've got to get rid of your... There you go. Okay, now you're good. Okay.
Okay, I'm behind the door. I'm with my mobile.
Okay.
So hello to everybody. And thank you, Vera, for this question, because I have been thinking many times that we should have a study group about Kundalini and studying this Kundalini rising. In the East, there is so much also references about the and particular knowledge. So let us do that sometimes. But I was just thinking while talking about the astrology and the signs. DK says that there are actually six signs that we should always, when we talk about one sign, as you mentioned, Michael, that we should study the opposing sign, because they actually are the one sign. And then also when we thinking about the soul functioning and what soul is doing and trying to do down to earth, and then we have to consider the crosses. So then the like four signs, or shall we talk about two signs, come together. And it just came one thought to my mind that we have to always study the cross. But then when we are talking about a triangle, triangles and the signs related to those triangles, could it be so that actually the triangles are telling us the method?
Wait, say again. Triangles are
telling us the method, how to solve problem which is related to the crosses.
Okay, it's an interesting thought. We'd have to experiment
when
with
we
it.
Think about, yes, when we think about crosses, it is always related to to initiations and the problems that the candidate have.
Right.
Candidates have on the crosses. So that's why I was thinking, could it be so running then those particular triangles related to those signs?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it could be indeed, because we're the trine in astrology of 120 degrees or 60-60-60 in a triangle are considered solutions. They are considered angles of more rapid solution, I would say, right, to help resolve crisis. Basically, for any focused in any particular sign, the cross on which that sign is found, and also the element of the triangle in which that sign is found, can all be brought to bear on the issue. So I think it's a good thought that we can look at the cross, look at a particular sign, and look at the particular triangle that is associated with the sign in question, and try to solve these things. Now, eventually, DK tells us that this whole science of triangles is going to be revealed in terms of the human mechanism. He's a little careful. He starts from the top, and he kind of reveals things in a broad and general way. But many of the esoteric healers, even right now, are getting into all of the different kinds of triangles that can be formed. I'm not saying they know everything about them or the method of awakening or all that kind of thing, but they're already moving in the right direction. So, you know, look at it, we have to make sure we understand the general principles before we get into all the intricacies. Otherwise, we might get lost in the trees and not see the forest, you know.
Sure.
So it's coming. And I think the next revelation from DK in the year 2025 and beyond is going to be very astrological. He tells us about that. But it's also going to have a tremendous amount of the first ray involved. Now, interestingly, Blavatsky was a first ray soul who made a third ray revelation. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the Alice Bailey was a second ray soul who made a second ray revelation. And let's just see who comes next, because I have a feeling the first and the third ray will be involved again, and it's going to be a tremendously first ray revelation. But what I want to emphasize to everybody is work really hard now to assimilate what we've been given. You know, we've been told the sad story that the Alice Bailey books are disappearing from the bookshelves and a lot of glamorous stuff is taking its place. We have to stay clear about this. And those of us who know its value, we have to become repositories of as much of this esoteric truth as we possibly can, so we can defend against all the nonsense. And it's necessary to do that, because otherwise illusion will descend, glamour will descend, and the truth will be lost. Mm. Okay. Thank you to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Other thoughts here, questions, thoughts? You know, just be brave. Don't worry about it. We all know practically nothing compared to what DK knows. So we're just, we are courageous in our asking of questions, and eventually we can answer them for ourselves. You know, we inquire the way. That's the very first responsibility here. We inquire the way. Okay, I'm looking. Brett will keep me alert if I miss somebody, you know. Anyway, I think it's been very interesting. We've been speaking about the technique of light. You know, it's largely a mental method directed from the plane of mind. Soul energy is involved, but with the technique of presence, we have something more. We have the intuition involved, and maybe very few of us know what the intuition really is, but we did do some study on it, and we discovered its difference from psychism per se. The intuition reveals the whole, it reveals love, it reveals the great light. Just check, go to the beginning of this book. I hope you all have it, or if you don't have it, you have it on the CD-ROM, and look around page 3, 4, 5, 6, right in there. He gives definitions of these very important factors, like knowledge, like wisdom, like intuition, you know, and he gives the bigger point of view, so that we know when we're dealing with intuition, it's a very big thing. It's not just, oh, I know what's going to happen. I've got the feeling. I've got, you know, that's, he calls that a psychic hunch. Okay, it might be correct, but it's not intuition. We studied that together, and hopefully we remember the scope of intuition. It's very broad. Okay, anybody else that would like to offer any thought or question or whatever? Not that I can necessarily answer everything, but, you know, somehow give it a try. Okay. Right. Okay. Well, look, you know, we're going to continue here. The world is in need. I can't believe it. We're said to be living in a post-truth era. Have you ever heard such nonsense in your life? People have lost their respect for the truth. So when the Christ says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, TK describes what this is all about. And when we lose the truth, we lose the way to the Christ. This is happening all over, and it's particularly acute in the United States right now, where the energy of fabrication, the inventing of reality, is taking the place of the humility, which actually reveals in truth reality. So we have to hold firm to the truth, and remembering the theosophical motto with their emblem, you know, there's a serpent, Ouroboros, it's swallowing its tail, and basically it says there's no religion higher than the truth. So right there, we're opposing the sixth ray to the fifth ray and the second ray. Not that they can't get along, of course they can, but right now we have a threat upon the truth, and we students of esotericism, who have studied long and hard for many years, we have an obligation to uphold as much truth as we can possibly contain and put it forth, both through the power of our thought and through what we write and through what we say. We put it forth to stand as a bulwark against this inventive nonsense, which is serving the lower ego and the astral plane desires. This has to end, and I hope after this period of amazing veiling, it will end. I trust that's the case. Okay. All right, then. Well, I'm very happy you're here, and now let's have a meditation. And as I said, this meditation will be our last one on egotism per se, which certainly doesn't mean that we have solved the issue. Not by any means. It's going to be with us a long time. But if people like us can overcome the great heresy of separateness, if we can begin to perceive in wholes, if we can see the symbolic nature of all that is perceived in the lower three worlds and make the link and the bridge to the reality which produced the symbol, then we are on our way. We have a lot of responsibility coming up, friends, a lot of responsibility. And maybe no one will see us work. We'll be working behind the scenes, but that's okay. The hierarchy is working behind the scenes too, right? And they're tremendously effective. I mean, you know, Master DK, he's somewhere in some form, and he's communicated with us via his words and his thoughts, right? He doesn't have to be in front of a classroom to do what he does. All right, here we go. So there are here some of us, 32 of us, I guess, the 32 degrees which precede the 33rd. And we just get that sense of being part of each other in the silence. As if we are one instrument, one mechanism, one being, one consciousness, merging and blending with each other in the field of consciousness, and working subjectively. Now we're going to use the protective formula, the long arm cross, with the center of the forehead, the chest, left eye, right eye. And we will sound the protective formula because we're working in an area where it's easy to be overcome and not even know that it's happening. So we take to heart the statements in this protective formula. As a soul, I work in light, and darkness cannot touch me. I take my stand within the light. I work, and from that point, I never move. And the light is our great protector, because the glamours that we're seeking to dissipate, these dark clouds, veil the truth, they hide the light. But the light is the salvation, and we are all the light of the world, eventually, to realize this is the case. So, we're working with light in this particular meditation. So in these preparatory stages, we are first, through our imagination, we will be aware of the light of matter. It's what really underlies the material demonstration, both etherically and physically. And the light of mind, which helps us reason and arrive at truth through the reasoning process. It's much more cumbersome than the straight flash of straight knowledge or intuition, but it's what we've got. So we take these two lights and we blend them, lifting the light of matter up to the level of the mind, and there blending it with the light of mind on the mental plane. We imagine this. And then we think of the soul. People visualize it in different ways, you know, the point of light above the head, or the somehow the entire egoic lotus with its center, perhaps above the head. We meditate on soul contact and on the recognition of soul light. Let's do that. And we will, as it were, bring that soul light, the sense of which we now have, we'll bring it down and blend it upon the mental plane with the two lesser lights of matter and of lower mind. And so there will be a triple light, and we'll visualize that happening. Soul light of revelation, the light of reasoning, and the light of vitality. These are all blended into a triple light, which is one within our mind. And then we will say together, followed by the sacred word, the light is one, and in that light shall we see light. This is the light that turns the darkness into day. Now the darkness is glamour, and the day is the light of day, which is eventually the intuitive light. Then we work with the formula itself. And while we're working with the formula, and as the words are said, the group members visualize the great searchlight that they have created, that they're turning on, and it's being directed towards the astral plane, doing the things that the formula tells us it is doing. So, we say together, as we turn on our searchlight, group searchlight, direct it out onto the astral plane, we say, radiance are we and power. We stand forever with our hands stretched out, linking the heavens and the earth, the inner world of meaning and the subtle world of glamour. We reach into the light and bring it down to meet the need. We reach into the silent place and bring from thence the gift of understanding. Thus, with the light we work and turn the darkness into day. So when we work with the words of power, we have to have understanding of what we are doing, why we are doing it, what these glamours cause, and what would be the condition if we were released from these glamours. So now we're going to strengthen our being with the spiritual will, what is the source of the will? Well, we can't get into the ultimate source, but from our monad to the atmic plane, through the jewel and the lotus, through the synthesis petals, and through the sacrifice petals, the source of the spiritual will. So we envision our beam sponsored by the group, the beam of triple light as one. In this case, it is a revelatory and destructive beam strengthened by the will, and we say, with power upon its beam, the light is focused on the goal. The goal will be the dissipation of the dark clouds of glamour, in this case, the magnifying and minimizing effect of egotism, magnifying one's false self and minimizing everybody else. That quality of energy has to be dissipated. With a true sense of proportion under Libra, it can be. So now here are the words of power. And as we utter these words of power together, we will visualize our reinforced beam of light, excuse me, penetrating into this glamour, which makes of the lower ego too large a presence, out of proportion. And we're going to see to the weakening of that inflation, which victimizes so many people so they can't see their own value in relation to that of others. They're always greater, or even the reverse, they're always less. But proportion is missing. So we visualize the beam as we use the words of power. And we see the work going on, blocking the appearance of the glamour, negating the quality of the glamour, destroying the vitality or life which supports this inflated glamour. We say, and visualize the process, the power of our united light prevents the appearance of the glamour of egotism. The power of our united light negates the quality, this inflationary quality of the glamour from affecting humanity. The power of our united light negates the quality of the glamour from affecting humanity. The power of our united light destroys the life or vitality behind the glamour. So there is no vitality to uphold this inflation of the lower ego. So you can use these words now in your own inner mind as we have our moments of silence and intensity of purpose as we see the work proceeding, weakening and dissipating this glamour. We'll 5 minutes of silence. The dark clouds are dissipated. The false inflation of the lower ego is devitalized. There's no vitality to support this swelling of the lower ego out of proportion. Proportion exists on the plane of desire. We co-measure our desires according to the divine plan. And the Son of Truth, the Son of Reality, shines forth within our own astral body and within the astral body of humanity. And the obscuring veils are destroyed. And the intuition and the power of the soul can be transmitted increasingly through the astral vehicle. The truth takes the place of falsehood. So we withdraw now our beam onto the mental plane. We turn off the search light, realizing we can work on our individual glamours this way, if we see them, of course. Study the book around page 100 and, let's say, from 120 to 124. See the individual glamours to which you are most subjected. And we can use the individual searchlight. And for the more powerful group glamours, we identify with the group. We can do this daily for even a few minutes, having the protection of the group and contributing to the demise of these dark clouds. So, we will close this section of the program, our meditation, with three ohms, affirming that some measure of work is done and some measure of glamour is weakened. And as I sound those ohms, I always visualize the dissipating sun, the results of the clearing of the glamour. I want to just mention here this quote from Oppenheimer, which Brett found. It's an amazing quote. You know, Oppenheimer said, seeing the effect of the atom bomb, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. So there's that huge identification with the first ray and the fifth ray. We know that the fifth ray souls do resolve upon the first ray, generally considered. He realized what it was and the power that had been unleashed, a great spiritual event, said the Tibetan. Now, Brett, I'm not sure, or Joe, whether we have, do we have the what's it called, the link here for the ingress into Aries, the service meditation for tomorrow? Let's see, Tuya, what time do we, yeah, do you have it there, or can you get it?
the ingress
I thought we might.
of Aries was on the 20th. So do you mean some other event, Michael?
Oh, yes, of course. Right. It's Annunciation Day. It's for the Rue Rose sisters. I apologize. Too many webinars. I've had one webinar too many. One broadcast too many. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Sure. Okay, everybody. Well, then we'll see you. Thank you. Tomorrow morning, we do our Invocation of the Soul of Nations. And on Sunday morning, the Attracting Money for Hierarchical Purposes. Okay, so enjoy your Aries energy. I'm going to, and I'll try to keep my head straight here. Thank you for attending, and we'll be working with you subjectively, interiorly, and hopefully powerfully to help turn around these very, very difficult transitional situations through which we are passing. Yes, Soul of the Nations, Invocation of the Soul of the Nations, tomorrow morning. My wife is advising me. I guess I have a scrambled brain at the moment. Okay. All right. Bye-bye. See you later. Thank you for attending. What in the world was I thinking?